Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click listen live, and enjoy the show.
This is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Here, our goal is to look beyond the superficial, to encounter the essence of the human experience, to explore new and creative ways of meeting life's obstacles, challenges, and opportunities successfully, and to discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of mind, body, emotion, behavior, and spirit. At this time in history, we desperately need to heal and transform at both the individual and the collective level. Therefore, in each episode, we try to bring you intelligent conversations with the movers and shapers who have created the new medicine and other holistic approaches to individual and collective healing. Along with this, you will receive practical tools and experiential guided imagery meditations to help integrate the wisdom our guest brings us. So once again, it is time to relax, focus your mind, and open your heart to the power within. Welcome to another paradigm-shattering conversation. Today's episode is another in this series of deeper conversations with the movers and shapers who have contributed and are still continuing to contribute to the new thought movement that has given rise to the field of holistic healing, our studies of ecology, and the blending of Eastern philosophy and religion with the Western scientific model and other such forward-thinking disciplines. Our guest today is an extraordinary woman who has contributed enormously to all of these areas. Our topics will be compassion, empathy, love, life, and death. I first met today's guest, Joan Halifax, back in 1970 at Esalen Institute down in Big Sur, California. That was the time where I and my colleagues were trying to craft a new approach to the healing arts and sciences that we called holistic medicine, pulling together a way of treating scientifically mind, body, emotion, and behavior, all under the guidance of a higher power that we might call spirit. And it was on one of those heady days back in the 1970s when I stopped by a friend's house in Big Sur, and there I read a poem that was to change my life. The poem was written by a Vietnamese monk, a member of the Chien Hep Order of Buddhist monks who, during the Vietnam War, insisted upon helping anyone who was suffering, regardless of whether they sympathized with the North or the South. As a result, both North and South Vietnamese soldiers considered them to be enemies, and they were executed as traitors. You may recall some of the monks drenching themselves in gasoline and immolating themselves to protest the killing that was going on over there. At any rate, toward the end of the war, one particular monk, this one, went to Hong Kong, where he was busy attempting to convince the authorities in Hong Kong to accept the Vietnamese boat people who were escaping from South Vietnam as the avenging Northerners came south. These poor people were packed into little boats with the very meager possessions that they could carry on their back. And often, in the middle of this crossing, they were attacked by sea pirates who stole all their belongings and often raped the women. And this poem was written soon after the monk had spoken to the occupants of one of the little boats, and he heard the story of a young girl who had been raped during one of those raids, and in utter shame had drowned herself. The title of the poem is Call Me By My True Names. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I still arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in every second to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with wings still fragile, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I am the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond. And I am also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks. And I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after having been raped by a sea pirate. And I'm the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I'm a member of the Politburo, with plenty of power in my hands, and I'm the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom in all walks of life. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills up the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all my cries and all my laughs at once, so I can see that my joy and pain are one. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up, and so the door of my heart can be left open, the door of compassion. When I read that poem, I felt something stir inside of me. And I thought to myself, this man knows something very important, and I want to find out more about it. I read the poem over many times and learned from it. And then I began to look around to try to find out who it was. And, of course, his name is Thich Nhat Hanh, who is probably the best-known Zen Buddhist teacher in the world, and among others of those that he has inspired is Joan Halifax, that is our guest today. Roshi Joan Halifax is an anthropologist and an activist, and she's been described as a wild child of the 60s and as a celibate priest. I first met Joan in 1970, probably 72, down at Esalen Institute, where I was working to help craft a new approach to the healing arts and sciences. Joan was born in New Hampshire in 1942. That makes her exactly the same age as I am. At age 4, a serious virus caused her to go legally blind, from which she recovered a couple of years later. She was drawn into the American Civil Rights Movement and participated in anti-war protests, received her Ph.D. in medical anthropology and psychology, and worked at the University of Miami School of Medicine. She went to Mali, where she studied the indigenous Dogon tribe, and during the 70s went to Mexico to study the Huichols. With Stan Grof, she jointly published the book The Human Encounter with Death in 1977. She is the founder of the Ojai Foundation, an educational and interfaith organization, and the Yupaya Zen Center, located in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The center offers Zen training, in addition to various courses and retreats on topics such as engaged Buddhism and caring for the dying. Joan has done extensive work with the dying over her career. She teaches the techniques of being with death and dying. She is a priest in the Japanese Zen religion and has extensive ties to Tibet and Tibetan teachers, whom she has studied with since the early 1970s. She is the founder, abbess, and head teacher of the Yupaya Zen Center there in New Mexico. And we're so pleased to have you with us today. Joan, welcome to Conversations with Extraordinary People.
Well, thank you, Emmett. So nice to connect again.
Yes, it is. Perhaps we can begin by hearing a little bit about your personal history and what have been the guideposts that have welcomed you along the rather remarkable path that you have been following.
Well, you know, it's interesting to, as you mentioned, to have been born in 1942, because we're both war babies. You know, we're both people who were born in the Second World War. Our journey took us association with the Korean War, and then there was the war in Vietnam, and then there's Iraq, and now, you know, the Middle East is evolving. And I feel that that arc of history is associated with, for many of us, a deep sense of commitment to social transformation, how we can actualize in our lives and in the life of the world of wisdom and compassion.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've heard it said that compassion is a quality that develops in people only when they've been exposed to certain conditions. And as I mentioned, I know that you have had a condition that left you partially paralyzed and blind as a child. And I'm wondering if your experiences at that time may have had a formative effect on your spirit and psyche.
Well, I think you're right. It's such an experience for someone the age I was when this happened.
Uh-huh.
It really turned me inward. And I, you know, inadvertently discovered I had an inner life. It was kind of a surprise. I saw it more clearly in retrospect. But there I was in relative isolation, and having the opportunity to be contemplative without, structure or preparation. So that was one thing that was really significant for me. And that was combined also with the fact that I wasn't very well socialized. You know, kids who are 4, 5, and 6 years old have friends, and, I was not a person who had friends that time. Pretty isolated. And so that experience, part of the experience made me very comfortable with solitude. And I think a third factor had to do with my parents, who were very wonderful people. But like parents of that day, they were, maybe so prepared to take care of me, so they hired a remarkable woman whose mother had been a slave. And this woman carried a sense of freedom and also was so unconditionally loving that her psyche affected me very deeply. And it's, you know, one of those pieces here. There's a humble person, a person without means, a person of color. I was, my family lived in a restricted community, so my father would pick her up and, you know, bring her to our house and so on. And she cared for me. And so the values that I developed, you know, from my childhood on in relation to social justice were influenced by her. I think that in my own situation, that adversity gave me a lot. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that fun to go through, but it's what, you know, I often say to people, it's not the cards you're dealt, it's how you play your hand.
Yes.
And I kind of feel like I've done my best to play my hand to benefit others.
Mm-hmm. Can you say, what was the woman's name who took care of you? Do you happen to know that?
I do. Her name was Lilla Robinson. Ah. She actually stayed with my family, you know, after I got better and was sent off to school to a boarding school when I was a teenager. She stayed with my family, and, you know, until she, my family got old, and mother and father were old, and she was old.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, she just became quite integrated into our family system.
Huh.
She was a great person. She just had so much love going for her.
Yeah.
And funny enough, her three of her daughters ended up being preachers, and I feel like I'm sort of following in those footsteps that, you know, I just wanted. They wanted to share about God, and I just, you know, want to share about the Dharma. But it's all about basic goodness.
And so you were between 2 and 4 years at the time?
No, between 4 and 6.
Between 4 and 6. Uh-huh. So you learned meditation early.
Yeah, that's probably the case. You know, that's probably exactly, I got pride.
Yeah, I want to ask you just one more question. If you could imagine back that far, in terms of what may have been transmitted there, and I had my experience was a very unique one because being raised as a Negro and having, of course, to live then in a black ghetto area in New York City, but because I happened to be brilliant, I lived in an all-white world in education, in school, and in college, and medical school. But something I noticed very early on was that there were certain qualities that I found among those in the black community who still had the old time spirit. What they knew seemed like the white people didn't know anything about that. And at the same time, there were things that white people knew that the black people didn't get. It was a fascinating experience to shuttle every day back and forth between the two. And I know that a good deal of what I've tried to bring into Western medicine is something that I had learned through those personal experiences. What do you imagine you might have received from her?
Well, you know, that the word soul comes up for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that she had a lot of natural joy, and she had a lot of selflessness, and she was very funny, and she loved to sing, and it's something I actually love to do as well. You know, the sense of humility, of humbleness, but also, you know, power. She had a kind of self-confidence. And also the stories that she told me. You know, she sang a lot and she told me stories. So I think I developed this incredible love and deep appreciation, love of and appreciation for Indigenous culture. Because,
yeah.
You know, her mother, is, as I said, had been a slave. And, you know, her roots were in Africa. And I ended up going back to Africa, or going to Africa, in a way to find her spirit and also to understand, you know, what kind of racism or what kind of world generates racism. I didn't understand, you know, how people could be so objectifying and so cruel and prejudicial.
Yeah.
And, you know, her courage. But she was, you know, she was just a very humble but very confident and fun person. And so, you know, I'm not sure I have any of those qualities, but she did infuse me with some, you know, she, anyway, I don't know what it is about me.
Uh-huh.
Other people can say it. Bad, good, or indifferent, but, you know, she was a great person, and all I have to do is, you know, think about her, and my life gets brighter and more happy.
Huh. Wonderful. Well, you know, much of my life has been really devoted to what the science is, and the area that I was interested in is to discover really what was life, this fascinating thing that makes us different from rocks that we call life, and what is healing. And what I finally came down to is that life is this process that emerges when atoms begin to bond, not in an ionic way, in which there's polarity and instability, but when atoms bond as the carbon atom has taught them to bond by sharing electrons. And the notion of sharing and togetherness means that we can have molecules not just consisting of two or three or four atoms, but hundreds and thousands of atoms, and therefore we can have protein, and therefore we can have DNA, and therefore we can have ourselves. And that process of sharing, the sense of oneness, the sense of community that then went on to hold together a single cell or a multicellular organism or a family or a tribe, and the experience of this fundamental energy, which seems to be at the essence of life, is an emotion. When we feel it emotionally, we say it's an emotion of love that holds us together. So for me, love and life and healing are simply different words for exactly the same process. And that has a lot to do with, well, empathy, being the ability to perceive what another person's emotional experience is, and then having that same experience in oneself, say, with our mirror neurons or something like that. And that really then is the essence of individual life, and it's the essence of any successful collective existence that we have together. So I'd like for you to just kind of share what's what you find most interesting and exciting about what you've learned about empathy and compassion and healing and life.
You know, I think, you know, we can begin first by differentiating empathy from compassion. Even though it's been conflated, Emmett, by quite a few social psychologists and popularists, in fact, what we're doing now, the people who are interested in neuroscience and social psychology, like Tanya Singer, Max Planck, Mitchie Davidson, Al Kasniak, and others who are leaders in this field of neuroscience and social psychology, is seeing, in fact, that empathy relates more to the experience of emotional or affective resonance. You know, as you described, you're really being able to feel into the experience of another. And also, there's cognitive empathy, which is a little different than affective empathy, which is described as perspective taking, and, you know, the more popular way of putting it is mind reading, that, you know, you're able to see out through the eyes of the person and really how they see the world. But that is different from compassion, though empathy and perspective taking are often involved in compassion. Just being able to feel how another person feels doesn't mean that you feel concerned for them. And just feeling concerned for them doesn't necessarily mean that you want to help them. And so compassion entails a number of features, which, you know, I'm happy to share with you if you want.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, I'll sort of go into it a little bit.
Yeah.
Including the ones I just mentioned, you know, concern and then care. But there basically can be no compassion without attentional balance, without having the stability to be able to really perceive the suffering of others. And that stability is something that's quite difficult to realize in our culture, where our attentional field is co-opted by so many forces. And it's dispersed, it's divided, and we're subject to incredible distraction. And I think it's one of the reasons why mind training or meditation is becoming more popular, because our attentional capacity is so challenged in the world today. Another feature of compassion that is important, Emmett, is our sense of pro-sociality, which is the opposite of antisocial. That is, that we experience kindness, that we care for the world, that the mental attributes associated with positive psychology, if you will, are engaged in our own processing. So it's clear from interesting research in neuroscience that we can actually cultivate a pro-social attitude and diminish those neural circuits, or networks rather, associated with skepticism, cynicism, objectification, and such. So, you know, these two features are, you know, part of a complex system that prime compassion. And they're two features that are, in fact, very trainable features. And there are other features as well, including more cognitively based features. But just to go back for a moment to attention and affect, one of the things that we know is that attention biases affect, and affect or our emotions biases attention. So these two dimensions of how we process the world are, in fact, interrelated in kind of interesting ways. And then, you know, intention is also another critical factor, and that we, you know, if our intention is selfless and not selfishly oriented, and that our base is, we have a strong ethical foundation, that's another dimension which is important, that we're able to actually have a strong moral ground and to have moral sensitivity in order to develop moral character. So intention, motivation, and aspiration, which are clustered, they're slightly different in quality, but they're clustered together, are this is an area that's very important in terms of compassion, because having selfless intention is a base for compassion. Whereas a selfish intention can actually be entangled with empathy and cause an individual to be suffer from empathic distress.
A moment ago, you talked about selfish versus selfless, and I'd like to focus on that for a moment. I'm reflecting back to when Justice Sonia Sotomayor was undergoing her confirmation process prior to being confirmed. There was a great resistance by certain members of Congress to the notion that she might be an empathic or, God forbid, compassionate justice. And in fact, wasn't it Jeff Sessions who was the ranking minority member of the Senate Judiciary Committee who said something like, empathy is prejudice, identity is discrimination, and that empathy for one party is always prejudice against another. So I think the notions about empathy and compassion are kind of screwed up in our world, but our basic tenets have been, have they not, greed is good, and he who dies with the most toys wins. So the self is a big deal. It's about promoting myself. It's about, I take the new word for last year. The most popular new word is the selfie. We're taking pictures of ourselves. We don't even need somebody to take a photograph of us anymore. So the confusion, what does selfless mean? Does that mean I cease to exist as a human being and become a robot, or what does that mean?
There's a wonderful book about Dogen that Kaz Ta-Nehisi translated passacles from, and from Dogen, and the introduction by Norman Fisher, and he has a line in the introduction. The book, I think it's called Beyond Thinking. And he's got a line from the introduction, and he said the line, I think I'm quoting it right, something like, enlightenment is basically being unselfish. And, from one point of view, the issue around the self in Western culture is a very interesting issue because we're so self-oriented, as you point out. And from another point of view, when we look at Buddhism in practice and you begin to really examine what you think is the self and everything that you want to, grasp onto in terms of, what the self might be, just dissolves, is this body the self? Are my emotions the self? And so on and so forth. So the construct of the self collapses when one is investigating deeply. Yet we in Western culture are so self-oriented, and it's not just a healthy self, so to speak. Our sense of self, of I-ness, is characterized by a lot of wounding. And so, in part, this is, what's great about Western culture is that a lot of therapy, makes it possible for people to begin to sort of work with the sense of being wounded. And yet, from the point of view of practice, one has to, heal a thing that you are ultimately going to let go of. So it's pretty interesting, how we're working with these concepts, because the sense of inadequacy associated with the self has also had a tremendous impact on, our global culture, whether we're looking at it from the point of view of the environment or point of view of, increasing aggression in the world, or the point of view of wanting to extend our life or to preserve our sense of self by, for example, having ourselves cryonically preserved. Uh-huh. So it's kind of we're at a very fascinating time, you know, where technology is intersecting with an entity that is a fabrication, and that is the self. Uh-huh. And there you have it, your selfie, which, of course, is this obsession with one's own situation. But compassion is really about unselfishness, selflessness. It is, you know, it is that capacity to be at in such a stable internal condition that we can perceive the suffering of another, that we feel concern for that suffering, and that we're able to, you know, from a motivation that's very unselfish, we want to help relieve the suffering of another. And then, you know, we've got the capacity to actually engage if possible. If not, at least wish the best for another. And there's, you know, a lot more to be said about compassion. I've done, you know, quite a bit of work on this issue, Emmett, you know, develop a heuristic model of compassion, and then a really fascinating intervention called GRACE, which is being used in a number of settings, in hospitals, in prisons, human rights organizations, immigration, and so on. Mm-hmm. Very interesting intervention that where you can cultivate compassion in the process of interaction by referring to the different dimensions that, you know, I briefly glossed over, but it actually is a paradigm that goes something like GRACE. It's a mnemonic that, you know, G is for gathering your attention. The R is recalling your intention. The A is attuning to self at the level of your somatic experience, your emotional experience, and your cognitive experience of body, heart, and mind. Then attuning to others. And then insight, considering really what serves. Grace. And then the E of grace is engaging, and then ending.
And then what?
Ending.
Uh-huh.
You know, really knowing how to complete the interaction.
And what was C again?
C is considering what will really serve. So it's the process of insight.
Uh-huh.
So it's gathering your attention. Excuse me, recalling your intention. Attuning to self. First, and then attuning to others, considering what will really serve, then E is engaging and ending.
Uh-huh. Very nice.
It's a very streamlined and inclusive process that's being adopted by, in many situations. We teach it to our clinicians here at the Pia Zen Center. I've been teaching it actually all over the world. It's being taught by people who just, you know, they kind of get it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, move out into the landscape in a significant way. Very, very interesting.
Huh. I like it. I very much like it.
Well, lots of people seem to like it.
Yeah.
I mean, there are journal papers, medical journal papers, that are published about it, Emmett, and people can write here to the Pia Zen Center. You know, it's easy to find us. And we can send you by email the papers, the journal papers. But you can also Google it on Huffington Post, you know, just GRACE and Halifax and Huffington Post, and you'll get the whole outline of it. Process.
And Upaya is spelled U-P-A-Y-A?
That's right, U-P-A-Y-A. You got it.
All right. And I just want to remind everyone that you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People, a publicly supported program. Remember to visit our very deep multimedia website, drmiller.com, drmiller.com. And there you'll find a great number of opportunities to learn. You'll find my videos, archives of these conversations with extraordinary people in case you've missed any, and a plethora of information on mind-body medicine, self-healing, software for the mind, as well as the free e-newsletter and the regular free guided imagery and meditation gifts that are there. You can support us by visiting our online store. You can go to drmiller.com and just click on shop at the top, or store, I guess it says. And there you'll find the audio and video programs that I've created that feature self-applied deep relaxation, guided imagery, and mindfulness meditations for healing the body, balancing and invigorating emotions, and overcoming bad habits and achieving peak performance. You can also support us by telling your friends, clients, patients, and those on your mailing list about what we have. And join in the conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/AskDrMiller. So back to Joan Halifax, our guest. And Joan, there was a... You've talked about having a strong back and a soft front. Say a few words about what you mean by that.
Well, the strong back is a physical metaphor for equanimity. And even if your back, has a problem, that's not what's really important.
Sure.
It's understanding it. From the point of view of the back is, as I said, a metaphor for this mental quality that we call equanimity, as our capacity to uphold ourselves in the midst of any condition. And then the soft front is the front of compassion, to really be open to the world as it is. So it's, one of the most cherished meditation practices that people ask me to share with them. How we cultivate this strong back and soft front. And, I feel like it's a meditation process, but it's also a way of life. I can't separate life and meditation to the degree that some people can. But it's, how do we open to the world as it is, and at the same time maintain balance, not go into states of distress, but also really not turn away from suffering. And, you probably know that my good friend and teacher, Bernie Glassman, who is a real out-of-the-box Zen person, he talked about this in terms of the three tenets of the Zen peacemaker order, of first not knowing how to, really be in beginner's mind, then of bearing witness, which is this process not of being a bystander, but of really inviting all things into the mandala of the practice, the hungry ghost and the joyful one. And then out of not knowing and bearing witness, responding with compassionate action. So this is another way that we can characterize strong back, soft back. I hope that was helpful.
Excellent. So the three tenets being not knowing, having that beginner's mind, because for the beginner's mind, there are many pathways available. Bearing witness, number two, and number three is to being able to respond with compassion. And I like that, and I like the notion of the strong back, because so often sometimes people consider empathy and compassion to be signs of weakness. People, someone's just suffered some terrible tragedy, and they shove a video camera in their face, and a few tears come out of the person's eyes, and they choke up, and then they apologize. and they call it breaking down. In other words, that to feel something, to care, to be touched by something is it gets a bad rap in the world. And yet, on the other hand, it's really things are quite the opposite of that, because there's a real strength that's involved in being able to do that, and as you say balanced and centered.
Well, you know, that's the world that you occupy, Emmett. Like, you're so familiar with it, and it's a bit my constant work and constant challenge. I think we were very lucky to be at Esalen in those years.
Oh, boy.
It was such an interesting time.
We
learned a lot.
Mm-hmm. I know it was incredible, because there was that, the openness and the freedom. I always thought of it as kind of an ambulatory asylum, where, you know, as long as you respected other people appropriately, it was okay, you know. I'm not in this world to live up to your expectations. You're not here to live up to mine. I do my thing, you do your thing. let others be, and within that, I think we discovered some really amazing things, and being able to connect in that way, and when we talked about selfish and selfless, and of course the selfish is that what I think of as being the small self. That self is really an illusion. It's a manufactured self, and it's manufactured basically by the limbic system, and it's created as it's the ego, that structure that we form within ourselves to defend ourselves against a highly invasive environment. And so we end up defending something, but we don't know what that something is at that point, because we're so busy defending it. And we're so busy avoiding feeling any pain, because we're not given that love as a child. You know, when we first started doing the germ-free experiments on guinea pigs by delivering the babies into a germ-free environment, then raising them to adolescence and seeing how they would be, how their immune systems would react to a challenge by microorganisms. All the baby guinea pigs were dying, all except for those of one particular lab technician. Everybody goes in to see how she's doing it differently. So they watch her deliver the baby guinea pigs into a little plastic bubble. And then she takes a cotton swab and she strokes each baby guinea pig. And everybody said, "Hey, what are you doing? What's that all about?" She says, "Oh, I don't know. I just noticed that when babies were born, their mothers licked them, and I thought maybe that had something to do with it." And of course it did, that a baby guinea pig needs that kind of attention and that kind of care, or it dies. And for me, that's a metaphor that the human being should be born into an atmosphere of love. We would not have survived if we had not had that incredible love. I mean, what cave woman's going to take care of this mewling, puking little thing if she doesn't love it? And that love became the center of the family and the tribe. It gave rise to the rites and rituals, the music and the dancing and the singing that gave human beings the ability now to move out of Africa. And of course, whenever we go, anyone who goes to Africa is going back to Africa. In fact, but that human being, that we need that love, and without that love, we don't develop. There's something that doesn't live within us. Fortunately, it can be brought to life later on, and I think that's the kind of work that you and I have been involved in. But if we're not given that sense of love, and you are the center of the universe, and you are beautiful, and you are spectacular. I mean, by the way, in time you learned that so is everybody else, but now you have a different core than the person who just learns these defensive maneuvers against the world, and that so-called self that's being protected by those defensive maneuvers. If the moment a person doesn't need the defense or is able to let it go, they discover there's nothing there. And then it's necessary to go deeper. So when I think of that, the notion of selflessness, it's really getting rid of all of those intermediate selves that block us from that more eternal and evanescent and ever-changing, uncarved block that is who we really are. So anyway, I'm rolling on, but it all has to do with that. It's just this horribly aggressive culture that we live in, and how we're invaded by that. And so just some comments about what this world is that we live in, and what we can learn from it, and what we can do to survive it individually and as a collective.
Well, you know, I think I've shared that in terms of describing to you the dimensions of compassion that I think are important for us to develop, which is, you know, how meditation trains attention, how it can train for pro-sociality, and how it can undergird aspiration and intention and cultivate insight and embodiment. And it might be because I've been in this practice for a long time, so, you know, I have a bias. That's what we, you know, our work at UPAYA has been basically about training caregivers. Doctors and nurses in this big training program for clinicians. By the way, they receive 54 CMEs and CNEs for that program.
Uh-huh, great.
It happens every May. Also the GRACE training, which is, you know, a very powerful program that we have here. But it's based in, not the romantic part of contemplative practice, but on, you know, the very pragmatic aspect of contemplative practice. So, Emmett, you're going to, I have to go. I've got a meeting at noon, but I just want to say it's just been so wonderful reconnecting with you. I'm just amazed by what you're doing. And I've loved your questions and the opportunity to share with your listening audience.
Well, it's been wonderful talking with you. And hopefully we'll connect again before the next 40 years are up.
I hope so.
Okay. Thank you.
Big hug to you.
And you.
All right, dear. Bye-bye.
Bye. And to conclude today's show, let's just take a few moments to go within and reflect upon some of the principles that our guest has shared with us today. If you can let yourself do so, take a deep breath in, and as you let it out, allow your eyelids to close. Take a deep breath in, and this time, release completely as you let it go. Sink down into that little pause after you've breathed out. And before the next breath comes in. And think about that amazing energy that starts each new breath. Think as you breathe out the words, "It breathes me." And imagine that you are experiencing the life force itself. And imagine that you can see that life force traveling through time, enabling people to support each other, enabling human culture to exist. Think of the love that must have existed within those first families to enable them to survive. Think of the love you've experienced in your life. Bring to mind someone you love or have loved, a person, a pet, wherever you can most quickly experience the feeling of love. Think of holding them, being close to them, hearing their voice, looking at them. Perhaps a certain memory comes to mind. Feel that quality of love inside, that quality of connection. And imagine for a moment that that quality of connection that makes us one with each other is the most important aspect of our lives. And that as we let go of more superficial senses of who we are, our possessions or our position or our dominance or power, that we can discover more of who we really are deep within. And imagine that you can ignore the rest of the world and focus upon those in this world that you care about, those that you serve. If you're a healer, it would be your patient. If you're an attorney, it would be your client. If you're a parent, it'd be your children, and so forth. And feel the love that's in that experience. Feel the sense of connection and deep caring. Sense within yourself your intention to serve this higher quality. Imagine yourself opening unselfishly and being enriched by the experience now. To help you embody the ideas and perspectives we've explored today, you might go to drmiller.com, click on Store, and look up Serenity Prayer, and also look up Power of Mind to Heal, Nurturing Spirit. The first of those is a CD, the second is a video. And in addition, of course, visit upaya.org and learn more about Joan and her work. Thank you so much for spending this time. Until we meet again then, this is Dr. Emmett Miller reminding you, stay tuned.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.